From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, families of victims from the 2012 movie theater shooting in Colorado are concerned about the upcoming release of Joker. Then audiences have been binge-watching the troubling Netflix series Unbelievable, and the executive producers are surprised by some of the responses.
Just over the course of this weekend, several people said how taken they were with a part of the story that felt like a whodunit, and we had never thought of it in those terms at all.
And I have a bonding moment with our intern over an obscure Scottish rock band. All that coming up on The Frame. Director Todd Phillips' take on The Joker, starring Joaquin Phoenix, is bringing up a now familiar conversation. What is Hollywood's role when it comes to gun violence, and how should the industry respond to concerns about excessive violence in film and TV? Brent Lang is executive editor for Film and Media at Variety, and he wrote about why the families of the 2012 Aurora Theater shooting are concerned about Joker. Hey, Brent.
Hi, John.
Can you first set up a little bit of the premise of Joker and how violence is part of its story?
Sure. So Joker is an origin story, and it takes a look at this man who's a mentally disturbed man living with his kind of crazy mother in a very rundown part of the city, and he has kind of aspirations of being a stand-up comic, and without giving too much away, those dreams don't come to pass, and instead he kind of gradually loses touch with reality, and a lot of violence ensues, and as part of that he kind of inspires this anarchic uprising in Gotham City. And it is a very violent, very bloody, very R-rated comic book adaptation.
So how much of the premise or the violence is behind the families of the Aurora shooting victims to write this letter and share their concerns?
Well, as far as I can tell, the families of the Aurora shooting victims have not seen the film. They're reacting to kind of coverage of the picture, and they say that, you know, in their letter they say that they've heard that it presents the character as a protagonist with a sympathetic origin story, and that gave them pause. And they're very clear, though. They're not asking Warner Brothers to not release the movie. They say that they support the right to free speech and free expression. But then they also sort of take a page out of Spider-Man and say, with great power comes great responsibility. So they're using this film to urge Warner Brothers and its parent company, Warner Media, and I suppose AT&T as an extension, to become more involved in the issue of gun reform. And they're asking for the company to support certain sort of specific means of social engagement. They're asking them to end political contributions to candidates who take money from the NRA. They're asking them to use their clout and their platform to pressure Congress to act for gun reform. And then they're also asking them to help fund survivor funds and gun violence intervention programs.
And it seems like the conversation around Joker is part of a broader conversation around violence in Hollywood. Your editor-in-chief, Claudia Eller, wrote an op-ed for Variety around the time that Blumhouse Productions' film The Hunt was dropped by Universal Pictures. The headline on that piece is why it's time for Hollywood to reconsider the amount of violence on screen. So even if the families from Aurora are not really asking Warner Brothers to limit the violence that is in their movies, it does feel like these things are starting to percolate up, and there might be a bigger conversation that's either about to happen or is already happening.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that this is a conversation that's been happening for a while. It's interesting. I talked to someone named Igor Volsky, and he runs an organization called Guns Down America, and he helped craft this letter. And I actually asked him sort of specifically if they were implying that you know, there was a connection between on-screen violence and gun violence. And he was very careful, and he said actually the science doesn't back that up, and that they aren't contending that. But, you know, just because he thinks that doesn't mean that other people don't. And I think it's a debate that's going to continue through the release of Joker and on to the release of other violent movies that Hollywood backs.
I want to play a little bit of what Joker director Todd Phillips and star Joaquin Phoenix said about this issue in an interview with the website IGN.
There have been a lot of think pieces written by people who proudly state they haven't even seen the movie and they don't need to. I would just argue that you might want to watch the movie. You might want to watch it with an open mind. The movie makes statements about lack of love, childhood trauma, lack of compassion in the world. And I think people can handle that message.
It's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for all of us. I think we all are aware of these issues and we're concerned. And I think that's why we talk about it. And I don't think that we can be afraid to talk about it.
So they're offering this defense, but it feels like this debate is probably going to get a lot more interesting really soon around movies like this.
Well, absolutely. And as you mentioned, it already existed around The Hunt. Now, I will just say that as somebody, I'm not a critic, but I did see Joker, and I can't say that I thought that it had a lot of profound things to say about violence in America or what spurs people to violent action. I didn't think that anything there was terribly deep. To me, it sort of played like a riff on Scorsese films like Taxi Driver, or King of Comedy, movies that had a little more depth. But that's my personal opinion.
And is it possible that this whole debate could affect the way the film is received? Might it have some consequences?
I think it definitely could. It could have consequences on the box office if people, you know, have safety concerns of some kind. It could have consequences on its awards chances because Joker is being positioned as an awards play by Warner Brothers. Joaquin Phoenix, who stars as the title character, has received a great deal of acclaim. But if the film becomes too controversial, potentially that kills its Oscar chances. So there's a lot of impact financially, critically, and in terms of awards.
Brent Lang is the executive editor for film and media at Variety. Joker opens in theaters on October 4th. Brent, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We should note here that the Aurora Theater, where the 2012 shooting took place, will not be screening Joker. Coming up next on The Frame, how do you tell a true story on screen that was already the subject of a Pulitzer Prize-winning article and an episode of This American Life? We're going to talk now about the new Netflix series Unbelievable, which deals with the issue of sexual assault. And I just want to note that this conversation could be triggering for some people. Unbelievable follows the true story of an 18-year-old in Washington State who was charged with lying about being raped, and the two detectives working a different case in a different state who eventually found the serial rapist who had, in fact, attacked her. The series is based on a 2015 investigative report by ProPublica and the Marshall Project. It was also adapted into an episode on This American Life and expanded into a book. Sarah Timberman is executive producer of Unbelievable. Susanna Grant, who was nominated for an Oscar for writing Aaron Brockovich, is the series showrunner. Here's Susanna Grant.
The one thing I tried to keep in mind was the thought that someday I would possibly have to look the real people in the eye and say to them, I honored the truth of your story. I did not exploit your story. And we told it honestly and with integrity. Generally, the feedback we've gotten is that the people involved do feel that while beat by beat, it doesn't look like their experience all the time, they do feel like it feels like what they went through.
Yes, I think that's emotionally true. And then factually, you know, I think we've been fact-checked a lot by people since the show launched, and people have gone back and looked at the book. And I think it's interesting. It's truth being more interesting sometimes than what you would make up in fiction. You know, life doesn't fit into a traditional narrative structure. And I think that Susanna was faithful in, you know, showing these detectives hitting dead ends, and we didn't know how people would experience that. And it's funny, only just over the course of this weekend, several people said how taken they were with a part of the story that felt like a whodunit, and we had never thought of it in those terms at all.
But, you know, knowing that the underlying material was out there and available to everyone, it wouldn't have occurred to us to do a big sensationalization of it or to veer far from it. And I think it was important for it to have real factual credibility in order for those ideas to be taken seriously. If you do a big departure, then that ends up being the story and people miss the point you're trying to make.
It felt like a responsibility, I think, to all of us. And, you know, we really tried to honor the stories of everyone involved in this.
So how do you strike a balance in letting the audience know what they've suffered without exploiting the incident?
Well, a lot of that is in how you show the incident.
That's what I'm talking about.
That was a really key decision made very early. I had never written a scene of sexual violence before. So when I first sat down to do it, I think my instinctive perspective was objective. And I immediately, before I had written a word, felt like I was a voyeur. And I thought, well, that we absolutely cannot do it that way. And also there's the sort of essential element within the story, which is that it's Marie's telling of her story that comes into question, that makes people wonder about whether she's telling the truth. So for those two reasons, showing it exclusively from her perspective seemed like the only way to do it. And then our director, Lisa Cholodenko, added a really wonderful idea, which is seeing where her brain goes when she's in such severe trauma as she looks at a picture that's meaningful to her.
And that image of her sinking down into the ocean is, for me, one of the most powerful things in the show. That it was Lisa's idea to do that. And, you know, it was, I think, a great way to portray something that we in our research, you know, learned is often true, that kind of survival mechanism that makes you or allows you to disassociate and to focus on one detail to the exclusion of other details. And then, you know, we really, I think, gained an understanding of how the brain works in the midst of trauma. And it's so strange now to hear people harboring the same kinds of misconceptions that we may have harbored previously about how people behave in the wake of trauma.
We're talking with Susanna Grant and Sarah Timmerman about the series Unbelievable. And it is, I think, in some ways about men and about male police officers and female police officers and how they work differently. I'm going to play two clips. One is from the first episode where Caitlin Deaver, who's playing Marie, is interviewed by a detective played by Eric Lang about what happened to her.
Let's start at the beginning. Last night before all this happened, what were you doing?
I was asleep.
And before that?
I was on the phone.
Bye.
You scream, I'll kill you.
Sorry to interrupt. Just to be clear, the blindfold and the condom were from his backpack, but the laces and the knife were yours. Got it.
And now I want to play a clip from the second episode. This is where Detective Duvall, who's played by Merritt Weaver, who's talking with another rape victim played by Danielle McDonald.
You okay? You comfortable?
Yeah, I'm good.
Amber, all our research has shown that the sooner a victim of a crime talks about it, the better his or her recall is. So if it's all right with you, I'd like to dive right in.
Sure. Where would you like me to start?
It is night and day about the way that these officers talk to these victims. And it's clearly important to the story.
It's very important. And the most obvious difference between them is their gender. However, I think it's really important to point out that there was another key difference, and that was their background and their training. And the detectives in Colorado had a lot of experience with sexual assault and had developed an understanding of what trauma does to the brain and how it changes how a person retains information and how they're able to relate that information. The detectives in Washington did not have that experience, and the sort of sequential relating of a story made a lot of sense in that sphere, but they didn't have experience with this.
Yeah,
and
it doesn't
really
excuse
shows.
It, but it does explain it, I guess.
It doesn't, but I guess what's important to me is that the takeaway not be that only women should be able to do this and only female detectives can do this effectively. Male detectives can do this effectively. Absolutely they can. And in a way, you know, saying that women do it better, let's men off the hook. And why do that? We are all capable of
and we're
compassion.
All capable of inattention and
yes.
Harboring misconceptions about trauma and bringing biases to it.
The other thing that is clearly very intentional on your part is to show two women who are incredibly competent. This is Detective Grace Rasmussen, played by Toni Collette, and Detective Karen Duvall, played by Merritt Weaver. I'm going to play a scene where, minor spoiler, they're not quite getting along for the beginning of their collaboration, and then they decide they're going to work together.
We're going to merge our investigations today, right now. You're going to move over to my joint. It's no offense, but we've got better toys. We're going to bring in the FBI. We're going to bring in the CBI. We're going to exploit every resource available to us, and we are going to find that sick mother. We're going to find him and arrest him, and we're going to put him away before he has a chance to hurt someone else, which, you know, he is out there planning to do.
In some ways, you know, they are superheroes because they do everything they can do at the sacrifice of their personal lives and their family to track this guy down.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to push back a little on that because, you know, I saw an interesting interview with Emma Thompson recently when she said in a lot of media, women seem to have gone from housewife to superhero without stopping in the middle for just a human being with a full range of capacities and emotions. And yeah, they are really competent and they're really driven and they're really dedicated, but they're fallible and they make mistakes. But it was important that they... that they'd be human beings. It seemed like a great opportunity to watch one of those partnerships that just felt real, just felt like real people.
And it didn't require a lot of embellishment because those two real women did that work. There are composites of some people involved with them, but that's what they did, which is, of course, the hopeful other side of the story when you're watching these two narratives. And one is sort of a downward spiral and one is this push, this dynamic push forward. That's what they did, which is what was so striking about the source material. It's, you know, it's inspiring.
I want to ask you about a different kind of credibility, and that's emotional credibility. Sexual assault is used in movies and TV shows as a plot point, and it might be depicted in a gratuitous way, but what happens to the survivor of the assault is completely irrelevant to the story that follows. And this is not true in Unbelievable. But I want to read something from Chanel Miller, who was the victim of the Stanford swimmer sexual assault who got a very light sentence. She just wrote a book called Know My Name. And this is what she says, because I think it's pertinent to what you guys are doing. You have dragged me through this hell with you, dipped me back into that night again and again. You knocked down both our towers. I collapsed at the same time you did. Your damage was concrete, stripped of titles, degrees, enrollment. My damage was internal. Unseen. I carry it with me. You took away my worth, my privacy, my energy, my time, my safety, my intimacy, my confidence, my own voice until today. That's what she said at her victim's impact statement at a sentencing. That seems so important to you as storytellers, that what these assaults have done to these women, yes, they're starting the story that you're telling, but let's not forget what they're living with every day.
Yeah, that invisibility was really important to us. The one phrase that really stuck in my mind in the building of this was the phrase you hear often, which is that the investigation feels like a second assault. And if you haven't been through that, I think it's hard to really understand that. And it's said frequently enough that I think it had started to lose its meaning. So it was important for us to bring people through the process with a character you have come to care for and understand on not just an intellectual level, but an emotional sort of gut level, what that process is. And as that invisibility is beginning for the person to see them, to witness that, you know, and to be a part of it and hopefully land that with people in a way that makes them care about it a little bit more.
Susanna Grant is the creator, executive producer, and co-director of Unbelievable. Sarah Timberman is the series executive producer. Sarah and Susanna, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Unbelievable is now streaming on Netflix. Up next on The Frame, a Scottish band you might not have heard of, but should definitely check out. Not that long ago, I was chatting with our intern, Paul Ratliff, about music, and I mentioned an obscure Scottish rock band that I've always loved called the Trashcan Sinatras. Paul's eyes immediately lit up. He, too, was a huge fan of the band and the first one that I'd ever met. More than three decades after the band formed, the Trashcan Sinatras are still together and touring as a stripped-down acoustic trio led by the band singer Frank Reeder.
We originally got together in like about 85. First recordings were like 1990, so we're just about a 90s band.
Your 30th anniversary is coming up.
Yeah, for releases, but we actually did a tour a couple of years ago to sort of celebrate our actual, the three of us who are sort of main, the brains trust. we've been together since about 87, so we did that a year or two back. We had a wee celebration tour.
So by 87, that's now 32 years that the brain trust, as you call it, has been together, which is about three times, if not four times longer than most bands stay together.
Including the Beatles, yeah.
I want to ask you about a couple of songs. I really want to ask you about lyrics because I have really enjoyed your music over the years and I've been intrigued and challenged by some of your lyrics. Yeah. I want to play a song called Obscurity Knocks.
Okay.
So the lyric is, I like your poetry, but I hate your poems.
Right, right.
I love it. I'm not sure I know what it means.
No.
Do you?
Well, I kind of think so. I heard someone say it back in the day. Or something like it. I can't remember precisely, but I thought immediately, oh, that's a nice way of expressing that, you know, that I like the thought of you, or I'm not sure I like the actual reality of you.
The other thing that I was really struck by is there's a craft and focus on word selection that is incredibly precise. And I'm thinking about a song where you say, he harbors thoughts on personal grief. I said your hardships, only one of a fleet that didn't go down well. It almost feels like a word puzzle in terms of the nautical wordplay. How do you all work together?
We have this kind of trough where everything's just fed in, you know, and we're all sort of aware of it, and we're all aware of the contents, what's in the kind of soup, the swill. And, you know, I can think right now off the top of my head of like pieces of a cassette with a piece of music that's been there for maybe nearly 30 years. I'm thinking I really need to do something with that one. That's a really good one. You talk a little soft, turn
off the radio. We're talking with Frank Reeder from the band The Trashcan Sinatras. In 1996, the band's label was bought out by Universal, and they lost distribution in the United States. Soon after, the band was forced to file for bankruptcy. Then, in 2004, the Trashcan Sinatras resurfaced with the release of an album called Weightlifting. As if making up for lost time, they toured the United States three times in the year that followed. I want to ask you about Weightlifting and how what that meant for the band, getting back together. Mm-hmm. How did that album come together and what did it mean for you all to get back?
We had come through the bankruptcy. We'd been like, finally, like the authorities realized we didn't have a stash of money in the Cayman Islands that we were hiding or anything like that. And they just said, leave these guys alone. So we got left alone. It started off as, let's clear the songs we have, you know, because we've been through a lot and we've been doing a little bit of writing and we've had a few things left over. So why don't we just clear this stuff up and then we'll maybe call it quits. You know, it was unsaid, but we had that kind of feeling. And then we just sort of started hanging out. Things happened, you know, lots of things were happening in our lives as far as individually recovering from that. We were doing it at different paces and with different substances probably as well. And we got, you know, we got to a point where we wanted to support each other still, we found out. We were still impressed by each other too, which I suppose is the main thing, you know. Paul was still writing things and I was going, wow, that's great. I want to do this.
Tell me about your upcoming tour and what you're looking forward to.
Well, we're doing Weightlifting and the album previous to that, Happy Pocket. And this is just Paul and John and I. So we got to the point where necessity meant the only way we could tour was the three of us. So we tried it and then that opened up a whole avenue of like, hey, let's go back to these songs that were actually written like this. So they actually started to feel like, oh, we can do these songs again. Whereas when you've got the full band, you're thinking, well, it's not possible to pin people to the back wall with us, so we won't even bother.
The Trash Can Sinatra's tour comes to the Largo Theater here in L.A. on November 16th, and that is it for today. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here tomorrow.